Tonight on Arena, it's review night with new seasons of The White Lotus, Big Boys and Hacks on TV, and new albums from The Lumineers, Manic Street Preachers and Candy Staten. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Tonight's TV reviews is what we'll start with. Three series launching their third seasons. First up, on a cold and wet February night, we have, I suppose we can welcome a trip to sunny Thailand, where we're checking into the sumptuous White Lotus Hotel and Spa for a third series. Among the guests, it's an anthology series, so new characters, but among the guests this year, we have a wealthy businessman holidaying with his wife and children, a young girl travelling with her much older boyfriend, and a group of old school friends, all of whom are disgustingly rich. 10 years ago, BAFTA award-winning Jack Rook took a semi-autobiographical play about grief and friendship to the Edinburgh Fringe to great acclaim. The TV executives picked it up straight away, and we got Big Boys, a sitcom about a closeted gay man with serious social anxiety and a lager-swilling lad's lad as his best friend. This week, Channel 4 launches the final series. And finally tonight in TV, we will be talking about Hacks, which arrives on Sky, who have taken the series from Prime Video, wherever they wanted to sell it, who made the previous two. The series explores the world of comedy and in particular how it treats women. And it's comedy in the US. It stars Jean Smart as a character called Deborah Vance, aging stand-up comedian with a young writer called Ava, who has lots of ideas for her, played by Hannah Einbinder. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser have watched all three. They're with me in studio this evening. We're starting with White Lotus, Chris, and this is an anthology series which kind of didn't intend to start out, I think, as an anthology series. The White Lotus is a super luxury hotel and spa. It has been in different locations, I think,
it
in
has,
the previous two seasons. And this year we are in, or for this season rather, we are in Thailand with a bundle of rich people, essentially.
With a bundle of rich people who've checked into the White Lotus Hotel, but some of them have probably already, you know, checked in, you know, to book their suite in hell. but they, I mean, Mike Weiss, actor, writer and creator, kind of manager of everything here, when he devised the White Lotus, he saw it as a one and done sort of deal. And it was about, you know, toxic white Westerners kind of descending on this, you know, idea of paradise or what they think is paradise. Somebody shows up dead. We rewind a week and we see all of these horrible rich people kind of, you know, trying to paper over the cracks in their lives until suddenly an explosion happens. So it's a little bit of a whodunit. Yeah. We're trying to figure out if somebody has killed somebody. We're trying to figure out who's dead. But the season was so popular that HBO said, we want another one. And the idea was formed for, the idea came about to make it an anthology. So first season in Hawaii, second in Sicily. This one's in Thailand. As you said at the top there, it's always new characters, it's always new holidaymakers, and there's always a new, you know, horrible event at the beginning of each season.
Yeah.
But there are certain characters, and again, a few more in this one, that kind of tie the whole thing together. So we saw Jennifer Coolidge in seasons one and two. In this one, there's a character from the first season, Belinda, who's a White Lotus staff member who thinks that she's starting a new life for herself in Thailand. It might go sideways.
Yeah, I think it just might. There are a couple of things about this. All three seasons have started with that, you know, very tense opening scene. In this case, it's the same thing. Guy swimming, you think, oh, here he is getting all his wellness, and suddenly there's gunfire happening around what should be an absolutely peaceful and calm place. Then it rewinds back a week. There is a sense of formula about it, for sure, but is that a problem?
There is shades of, I mean, I think, like Chris was saying there, Mike White is very, he knows what he's doing and he's very astute about the way he does things. So he understands that this is his third time around with this franchise. So he knows that we're getting a little bit used to it and we know the setup. And he does kind of, you know, make a reference to that about, like, you know, Belinda saying, oh, this is very, like, this reminds me of Maui, you know, Thailand reminds me of Maui. And there are shades of previous characters within these new characters. So, you know, you have someone like the Ratliffs, they're this family with, you know, parental pressures and various rebellious children, and they kind of remind you of the first season's Mossbacher clan, which, you know, had Sydney Sweeney as the eldest daughter, and it's this daughter Hunter. She's, you know, very in this very conservative family, but she's interested in Buddhist monasteries. And then her dad Timothy is played by Jason Isaacs, and he's spiraling out of control.
And her brother,
Saxon is Patrick Schwarzenegger, and he is this very oversexed, like the actual like embodiment of toxic masculinity, and that is very like Shane, who Jake Lacey played in season one. And so he knows that this is happening. He knows, but he's telling you that like, look, you know, there's going to be shades of it.
The other side of that is, if you haven't seen seasons one or two, it doesn't
matter. It's actually perfectly okay.
It's an anthology. Let's have a listen to the family. What's the family surname?
The Ratliffs.
Who are a normal family, according to them. But just listen to the way they talk. We'll hear members of the staff of the White Lotus in this as well.
Dan, I know I gave you shit, but this place is clutch.
I did my research.
You're always right.
Saxon was our holdout. We usually stay at the Caribbean.
Well, no. I don't need a vacation, so. I mean, I love working. What?
Saxon works for his father. They love it. It's Tim's dream.
It's pretty great.
How wonderful for you. How wonderful for you.
So, how many bedrooms are there?
Three. The master is through the common area, and then there is one bedroom on either side.
Okay, so, Lockie, you're with me.
You can sleep with me. I don't mind.
But that'd be weird.
Why is it weird?
Because brothers and sisters don't sleep together after they have full grown, you know, genitals.
Saxon.
What?
That's a bad word.
Stop! Stop! Saxon, please! Stop! Stop!
We're a normal family. You'll see.
Yeah, you are for sure, Parker. That's Parker Posey as Mrs. Ratliff there in the midst of all of that. Yeah, there's going to be secrets unraveling about everybody here. Yeah. We also have a couple of other interesting setups.
Three old school friends who their friends at the centre of this gang. You have Jacqueline, played by Michelle Monaghan, who is a famous daytime television star, and she has decided to pay for this girls trip to bring her oldest pals, played by Leslie Bibb and the brilliant Carrie Coon, on this holiday together. The idea being that, you know, we've been friends forever, and, you know, we know everything about one another, and we're the perfect mates. They're not. When one of them leaves the room, the other two tend to give out about them. And around it goes until one of them kind of makes the mistake of admitting that they voted for Trump. And that's actually the first time that I think maybe in three seasons that Mike White has said, you know what, we're going to bring a little bit of the real world
contemporary
in.
Politics.
And make it explicitly so.
I know two characters that you particularly liked, the actors as well as the characters, it has to be said. Rick, played by Walton Goggins, who's this quite much older man, dating this young woman called Chelsea, played by Emily Woods. I was asking you, sex education as well.
Emily Woods from Sex Education. And
great
Walton,
dynamic between the two
Walton
of them.
Walton Goggins, has to be said, it's so good to see him get an actual, he's a great character actor, and we know him from Justified or The Righteous Gemstones, but to see him to get this lead role as this very mysterious, you know, man who has this younger girlfriend who's played brilliantly by Emily Woods. She has got the best mix of the tragic and the comic in this season, I think. But he doesn't seem to have much interest in her. They're away together, and you would think, you know, the older man, younger woman dynamic, it'd be hot and heavy, but he seems to just want to ignore her and is on the search for redemption of the soul, but also out to seek revenge somewhere where you're not sure where or why. Mm-hmm. And this season, so if the first season was about class and the second season was about sex, this seems to be about the battle for the soul and what is enlightenment, and what is enlightenment to the massively disgustingly wealthy. What does it all mean?
I don't know if this was dealt with in the previous two episodes, but you mean there is a little bit of the rich Westerner and the exoticization of the whole, you know, the Thai, the wellness industry.
Oh, absolutely,
all of that is going on there. Is that, that's part of the satire that Mike White is giving us?
That is a little bit part of the satire. And Mike White actually, not so much in the first season, but this time around is kind of giving a bit more scope. Actually, we saw it a little bit in the Sicily season too, where it's like, let's check in on the staff members. So there is a bit of an upstairs.
Yeah, we get a bit of their story as well.
Yeah, it's sort of an upstairs, downstairs in the sun, except, you know, swearier, more satirical. I think the problem with this season is that it's going back to that formula. Once it starts off, it's like, oh, there's the explosion, there's the body, oh, rewinding a week. It's like, it's a little bit too samey. Yeah. And it's also...
And it's longer,
It's longer. So you had six seasons in season one, or six episodes, seven episodes, now it's eight. And you need to get to about, I'd say, 4 hours in before anything starts to happen.
Yeah, it's a lot of setup, but it's supposed to have to get all those characters.
They do, but 4 hours is a lot of commitment. That's a huge commitment in television.
Okay, yeah. Stars on it, Chris?
Beautiful to look at, brilliantly performed. Love the score that we were talking beforehand about how they've actually changed the famous theme tune.
Spoiler alert, be prepared. Yeah. They've changed the theme tune.
which I quite liked, but it's quite sluggish. So just, you know, you need to be patient. Three stars.
You need to be patient. And Jen?
I think I do miss Jennifer Coolidge as Tana McQuad, and it can feel a little bit like eating your vegetables when you're waiting for the dessert at the end. You want to get to that dessert quick enough, like quicker than that. But it's not lacking on drama. And I do think because we're aware of the formula and the rubrics and the scaffolding of The White Lotus, the payoff may not be as delicious this time around. So 3.5.
There is no dessert unless you eat your vegetables, Jen. Surely you know that at this point in your life. Okay, 3.5 from you. And the White Lotus starts on Sky this coming Monday. Mm-hmm. I think it's the first episode. And now it will be there. Interesting that Sky have taken it over from... Prime Video, but that's a whole another day's work. Sorry, I've got it all mixed up. We'll talk about that when we come to Hacks.
Yes.
Let's move on to Big Boys, the Channel 4 comedy about two very different young men who struck up, it has to be said, an unlikely friendship while at university. This is its third and final series. They've definitely we have heard these things said that's final series before. However, we have Dylan Llewellyn, Derry Girls, we all remember him from that, and John Poynting reprising their roles as the sensitive Jack and the gregarious and rather laddish Danny. There's such a great dynamic, and there's a whole group of people around them. Great dynamic here, Chris.
Yeah, there really is. I mean, at its core, and when it started out, it was about these two pals, played by Dylan Llewellyn and John Poynting, and how, you know, they are unlikely pals on paper. One of them, you know, at the beginning is this closeted gay man who has just turned 19. He spent like the last year in his bedroom, you know, afraid to go outside. He'd actually been caring for his mom since his father died, and he was all ready to go off to university. And then, you know, he cracked and he realized that, you know, he'd never really dealt with his grief properly. Mm. So he's out in the big bad world by himself, and he ends up, you know, roommates with this, you know, just as you said, that lager swilling lad who, you know,
John Poynting,
who is just everything that, you know, that Jack isn't. And but they end up becoming so close, and they really care for one another.
Jack
and they
is
have
also
this,
sensitive despite his laddishness.
He really is, because the thing with Jack is that, you know, he didn't have an easy childhood, and his mom and his dad scarpered. He lived with his grandmother who was looking after him, and he's also struggling with depression, you know, and he's on medication, and he kind of decides on and off when he'll be on that medication, and you know, which has disastrous results. But it's all about their friendship, let's get
Jen to give us a little bit of the surrounding characters, because we're going to hear a scene where Desiree, the Laverne Cox character, has just won a big amount of money.
Oh, I mean, like, you've got Jack and Danny, but you've got Corinne and Yemi, and Corinne,
who are pals. They were all university pals.
So, like, Corinne is now in a relationship with Danny, and that kind of moves the friend's dynamic in another way. And then Yemi was this very... brought Jack out of himself to make him comfortable with his sexuality. He is very out and very proud. Yeah. But then you also have Jack's really sweet mother, Peggy, played by Camille Kadoorie.
Yeah.
And she, in this season, is finally dipping her toe into the dating world and embarking on this relationship with a minicab driver, Russell. And then there's the irrepressible Shannon, who's played by Harriet Webb. Now, she's Jack's cousin, and she's a new mother, and she is just this whirlwind of chaos. And everyone gets the best lines, you think, in Big Boys, but like, she really brings it to another level. She is like the comic, like, center of this season, I think, because there is a lot of emotion in this season. There's a lot of laughs there, because being in the world of Big Boys is always a delight. It pinpoints a specific moment in our recent past that kind of triggers memories for you. So, but they do it with this, like, wink to the audience. So you're back in 2015, 2016. You're pre-Brexit, pre-Trump, pre-COVID. It seems like halcyon days. And it's peppered with these specific cultural references, like David is Dead, the iconic, like, celebrity Big Brother moment. They're watching that in the library. There's loads of references to Jeremy Clarkson leaving, like, a Top Gear, Ryland on This Morning, Eurovision. And it turns that very ordinary world of, like, Tesco meal deals and bingo into something that you think, I relate to that. I understand that. I know that that could, they could be my friends. And it celebrates that, those mundane moments. And in a world of, I think, high concept TV and like unnecessarily complicated plot lines that we deal with every week, it's just a joy to see characters interacting with each other and feel like you want to be
and
in their
big,
company.
Big group scenes where they all play off each other and the comedy is so well
and
timed.
And it's the small moments that
let's
trigger your memories, because it makes you go, that's what's important about my friendship, is remembering that that's the drink that they drink at the Tesco meal deal, or you know, that's their favourite person on X Factor. It's those kind of things that make it so relatable.
I think it's Shannon, actually. It's Shannon who wins at bingo. Is it Shannon?
Shannon does
win. Yeah, Shannon who wins
with
at
Nana.
Bingo. Yeah, and Nana said, don't be throwing the money out. Don't be throwing the money away. So here is Harriet Webb announcing to the... Oh, they're all gathered in the room. Where else would they all be other than in the house chatting to each other? And she's announcing what her plans are then with her big bingo win.
£17,000. I know, it's a life-changing amount of money.
That's not that much.
You're secretly a Tory and I hate it.
So I'm going to spend some of it on setting up Shannon Nannigan's Party Planners LTD Incorporated, and then an all-inclusive Holly Bob's your uncle to Greece. And you're all invited.
What?
Yeah.
You're not all invited. You're not. No.
Just invest it, Shen.
What in? Oil and gas? Nan, please. The world's on fire. Have you not heard of climate change? No. Instead, we are all flying to Greece.
Nan's right, Shan.
Well, Nan isn't coming, is she? Because she doesn't fly ever since Jack made her watch that 9/11 documentary.
Sorry, Nan.
I just really want to connect with my late father's culture. You know, I just want to celebrate the fact that I'm actually Greek.
You're barely Greek.
You're not the only one with a dead dad, Jack. All right, I have a dead dad too. I just don't go on about it every day. I'm sorry about saying that, but there's loads of gay bars in Valaraki. You're going to love it.
She goes on about it every second day. And she also, at another point, says something along the lines of, you know, I can't believe that you're spoiling your birthday on me. Classic kind of narcissism there. But that's the kind of comedy, like, it's rattling along.
Oh, yeah.
But yet they've managed to get these serious notes into it as well, Chris.
They have, yeah. It can be quite broad at times. It can rely a lot on, you know, the physical comedy of the performers at times. But there's an awful lot going on underneath. And it's extraordinarily difficult to marry, you know, devastating, you know, relatable real life drama with that sort of, you know, slapstick sometimes, sort of sitcom situations. Yeah. But I think Rook and his performers make it look easy. And
yeah, because I was going to say we didn't get it in that
we
clip.
Don't, but
Rook does a lot of the, and it's him himself who does a lot of the voiceover. This was a related to a friend of his who died.
It was, because we've known from the outset, you know, this is actually, it's based on stories from three different Edinburgh Fringe Festival plays and also from a book he wrote called Cheer the F Up. And he has said before, you know, this series is sort of 50-50 in terms of what's real and what's been fictionalised. But the whole time, the real life Jack Rook is narrating the series and addressing this character, you. And he never says who you is, but we know who you is. And we know that you took his own life. And this is a chance for Jack Rook himself to create this little alternative past for himself where he can say the things to his friend that he never got the chance
and
to.
And also an alternative future for his pal. And that's kind of... That's part of where the emotion lies. And that mix, to balance that out is an extraordinary feat.
It's incredible. It is something so very special because it's saying you matter. If you are out of this world, if you leave this world, you leave behind a hole. And if you just stay, if you just stick with it, things can change and you see what the life could have been like for him. And you will get the bumps in the road, but things will settle down. And then you see the real Jack Rook talking to the actor, like John Poynton, as Danny, and trying to convince him, like saying to him, look, in your 30s, things settle down. And I think Big Boys is about so many things. But through the three seasons, it's about the importance of TV. And from Jack's mother reading out the TV listings to him to stop him from having a panic attack, to, you know, his love of X Factor, that made him easier to talk about his sexuality to his mother, or to Danny's love of like watching Dross with the lads. But it's about how TV helps us understand different ways of life, informing those valuable connections and helping you empathize, and perhaps like even a valuable tool to recognize like meaningful relationships. And at its best, TV can be life affirming. And I think that finale of Big Boys is saying something to us. It's about like, please, you know, don't give up. Like tomorrow's another day, which is so important.
White Lotus hasn't said it's a final series. Saying it's a final series now, we see if that will stick, because there's certainly a spin-off in here from John Poynting, and who plays the love interest with him.
Azuka Doyle.
I want to see a series with the two of them after this.
For me, John Poynting is a star here, and he was speaking to The Guardian last week about how, you know, he's kind of played these parts where, again, he's always, you know, people think he's really the lad's lad, but I've never seen a better depiction of depression on screen in either a sitcom or a drama before, because he's playing a character here who is so vulnerable but is afraid to show it even to the people around him. And the whole time I was thinking, I've either known someone like him or been him at various points, and it's just so well done.
It's hugely emotional, the whole set of series. Seasons on this. Stars from you on this one, first of all, Jen?
I just think, as you said, John Poynting's performance has always been really masterful, but this is next level stuff, and I think it's a really valuable watch for anyone. But it's so knockabout funny as well. You're getting like filthy laughs, but you're also getting that real depth and emotion. So I think it's going out on a high, and it's 5 out of 5 for me. It has to be.
Yeah, I think despite the series turns, this show at times looks as if it was so much fun to make. There's a wonderful on-screen chemistry between everyone, so I'd love to see them all do something again at some point. It's perfect, and I can't wait to watch it again. 5 stars.
5 stars from both of you. All right, let us move then on to Hacks. We go to Vegas and the hinterland of the comedy circuit there. Deborah Vance, played by Jean Smart, stand-up comic whose life has taken an upswing after her comedy special was a hit. Now she wants to conquer the late-night TV world, but she may need the help of a talented young writer called Ava, played by Hannah Einbinder, who she had previously fired. I don't know whether you can come into this season three without having a fair bit of knowledge about seasons 1 and 2, Jen.
Yeah, I was worried for Chris because I'm locked in on Hacks, and like I think you need to know that the end of the previous season, at least you need to know the kind of ups and downs of Deborah and Ava's relationship, as in it is testy. It is not the easiest of things. But the good thing about Hacks is they're not pitching these women against each other. It's more about the way the industry ends up pitching women against each other. That's the most interesting thing about it. But I think you do need to come with some kind of clear-minded view of what is going on here. So Hacks, it was kind of based loosely, like Deborah Vance's character, on Joan Rivers, because she has like the QVC. She's a QVC like person. She's like broadcasting all the time about leggings and cardigans. She also has this obsession with buying antiques, overpriced antiques. She has her Rolodex of jokes, which Joan Rivers genuinely had, you know, like files of jokes that were sorted by subject. Yeah. These are all the same things about Deborah Vance, and she did have that chance to do late night TV that ended up disastrously and could be completely acerbic. So it's based on how the industry kind of shut her out. And then with the character of Ava being introduced, she is supposed to be this woke millennial that's going to punch up her writing and make her more relevant. So when we left season 2, she'd been fired. But now she's coming back into the fold because Deborah Vance is going to try and go for late night TV.
It takes quite a while for us to get the two of them on screen together, but I think they're such important characters that we need to hear a clip of the two of them. And this is the point when finally you say, oh, this is the young writer now talking to the older comedian. They meet at this convention.
They're at Montreal Comedy Festival.
And they're in the elevator, as they would call it, and the awkwardness is tangible. And then Deborah gets out of the lift, walks off to her room, and Ava's not going to be left in the lift. She follows her, as you will hear the audio change as we go along here. So here are the two of them saying hello after, what is it, 2 years, 1 year? 1 year?
How you doing?
Good. Real good. Really good. So, doing good, yeah.
You look well.
Thanks. And you look the same.
That's the goal. So, what are you?
I'm headed to a really cool party. We're on my way right now. It's on a roof. Top.
Fabulous. Oh shoot, it's me. It's good to see you. Have fun.
Okay. I look well. You got nothing on my new haircut. You're not gonna say I look like a little page boy or something?
No, I just thought maybe you'd put a child's wig on backwards.
There we go. Thank you.
Can I start on the blazer now?
And when I heard that, I said, now I understand the relationship between the two of them. But it did take quite a while to get there, because we get a lot of background characters and a lot of setup about the actual comedy circuit and how it works in America and the role of the agents and the talent spotters.
Yeah, that's true. The US comedy scene and the Canadian comedy scene will just be always so strange to me. I can just never get my head around the fact that, you know, stand-up comedians, certainly at the top, have a team of writers. Yeah. That's just going to be lost on Irish and British comics, I think. So you kind of do need to know a little bit about the background, but I am finding that fascinating. I do quite like following, Paul W. Downs playing Deborah's manager, Jimmy, because he's going around this comedy festival desperately trying to acquire new talent, because the other manager...
And his partner, his talent spotting partner.
Yeah, there's two at the minute, because the other managers are starting to make fun of them because, you know, all of their acts that they have on the roster they have the geriatric comedians. But Deborah Vance is immensely popular because of this special that she's done. She's no longer working with Ava. I should point out, I'm new to this. I'm figuring this all out while I'm telling you this. But there's a good storyline now in season three where Deborah always wanted to be a talk show host, and she was quite bitter at the fact that she was passed up for the late night talk show on CBC or whatever it was. And she gets the chance to stand in and gets the bug. And she thinks, I'm going to bring back in Ava to help me try and get that gig.
And you can see, I mean, it didn't take me long to work out, where the dynamic's going to be. Mm. But the opening, the first half of the first episode is all about the convention and the talent spotters and the agents and how they behave with each other. Let's listen to a clip with Jimmy, who is Deborah's agent, and Kayla, who works in the same talent company as him. They arrive in Montreal again for just for laughs, and there is a lot of language in this. There are a load of bundle of other agents around. Doesn't matter who they are. It's Jimmy and Kayla that you really have to listen to here.
Oh my God! Could you have driven any slower? We missed three shows already.
Yeah, well, that was harrowing. Why would you rent a $300,000 car in a new city with French road signs?
Because JFL is the comedy industry event of the year, Jimmy. Deborah's doing amazing. I want people to know we're doing amazing too. It's all about peacocking, baby.
No, it's not. Reps come to this festival to
cheat on their wives.
Sure, but we are here to see fresh, interesting new voices, okay?
Stop stressing. Me trust fund is Sue trust fund. Just charge it.
Thank you. She has a huge bag in the back, and also it's very sensitive. Be careful on the gas.
Yeah. Hey, Jimmy, Kayla.
Ugh. Hey guys, what's up?
Surprised to see you two here. You know this is new faces, not old faces, right?
Ha ha, very funny. Just so you know, we have a diverse roster of clients of every age.
Yeah, I saw you just signed Valerie Bertinelli.
Yeah, we did. Huge get. A lot of people wanted Valerie, but we got her, so.
And guess what? We only represent Valerie Bertinelli's non-cooking appearances, so you actually fucking don't know what you're talking about, Dan.
Whatever, we gotta go. Hey, good luck this winter. A bad flu season could knock out your whole roster.
Oh, shut the fuck up.
Oh, so the joke writers on this, on Hacks, are clearly good at what they do.
100%. I mean, I think the thing about Hacks is that there's a lot of talk about whether it is a straightforward comedy, like as in, is the bear a comedy? And I don't think it matters that much. You're getting the laughs, like the direct laughs from someone like Kayla, a character who is, you know, in that kind of frame, like that has those one-liners as well, like the relationship between her and Jimmy.
And there is a lot of comedy in it. Is the heart of it the relationship,
it
though, between the writer and the comedian?
Hacks works because of the chemistry between Jean Smart and Hannah Einbinder.
Both of them are brilliant.
Ava...
Jean Smart in particular.
Oh, well, that goes, in a way, it goes without saying. But Ava is at times, like, she's in awe of this woman, this pinnacle of the industry. And she's like this fangirl, a cheerleader, wanting to put Deborah at the top where she deserves to be. But she's also a dog's body, and she's an ashtray for Deborah's, like, burning ego. And she knows how cruel Deborah can be. And Deborah Vance as a character is a monster. And that relationship treads that fine line between comically caustic and outright abusive. But I think Jean Smart's depiction of Vance, she is just had to make herself a monster to survive that industry. She's isolated from the boys' club that comedy always was, but she can cut this really lonely figure, and you think that's just the way she likes it. Like, she never has to be dependent on anyone else, and she cuts people out of her life in this ruthless way. But you are totally seduced by her. You want to hang out with her.
Yeah.
I want to be at the bar with her, you know, sipping martinis and slagging off basic businessmen.
And for all the toxic nature of the relationship between the two of them, it's nothing, you know, the sycophancy of the stylist who, you know, she picks a dress and says, I don't know, I don't think so. Oh, no, of course not. What about this one? Yeah, maybe. Oh, no, that's perfect for you. You know, all this sycophancy that goes on between the stylist, but even the audience are laughing at jokes that aren't jokes.
It's very good at showing us that when, you know, these performers, when they get to the top, where do they go next? And there are some great scenes where Deborah thinks, well, I need to write a new show. I need to test it out. And she goes back into the comedy clubs, but all she needs to do is just kind of breathe and the audience laugh and they applaud her, and she's just surrounded by too many yes people, and that's why she wants Ava back. The two of them do work well together. I think I've got some homework to do because I'd like to see the beginning of their relationship. But it is very good at showing us that there's not, they don't have a healthy employer-employee bond. You know, she's like the arrogant mother figure, that's Deborah, and then obviously Ava's like the daughter constantly seeking validation, so their arguments are quite great. I do think sometimes though there were a lot of jokes in those clips. Sometimes time can go by where I'm not hearing many, you know, and it sometimes does exist in that no man's land between comedy and drama. So I'll go back, I'll give it another go. But if you haven't watched the first two seasons, don't do what I do and dive into the third one.
They're all available on Sky Comedy right now, or you have it, or Now TV if you have it. White Lotus will be available, and still pondering why Prime Video sold it, but maybe they got a bundle of money, maybe they need it, I don't know. White Lotus will be available on Sky and Now from February the 17th. Hacks 3 currently streaming on Sky and Now. Big Boys, Sundays at 10 p.m. on Channel 4, but all episodes are currently available on channel4.com. Jen and Chris, thanks very much. In case you hadn't noticed, it is Valentine's Day. If you're looking for love songs, today's album releases might not quite set the mood for that. The three albums tackle nostalgia, faith and introspection more than romance. First up, the Manic Street Preachers, Welsh band known for their provocative lyrics and anthemic sound, merged in the early 90s with Generation Terrorists, navigated triumph and tragedy, and their new album Critical Thinking explores themes of nostalgia and introspection, as I've said. Next, Automatic from the Lumineers, known for their 2012 global hit Ho Hey. The American folk rock band is known for their acoustic sound and narrative driven lyrics. And finally, Candy Staten, who I spoke to earlier in the week in Arena, and both Louise Bruton and Pat Carthy would tell me how taken I was. I was very taken by her. She returns with an album called Back to My Roots, celebrated, of course, for her soulful voice and a career spanning gospel and disco. Staten first rose to prominence in the 1970s with hits like Young Hearts Run Free and You Got the Love. At 84, she revisits her gospel beginnings, blending Americana with reflections on faith and resilience. But let us start, Pat, with Pat Carthy and Louise Bruton in studio with me. The Manic Preachers, a knack of turning complex lyrics into pop anthems. That's what they've always been doing. Are they at the same thing on this album?
I think so, yeah. They've always had these kind of lyrics that if you look at them on paper, if you were that way inclined, you know, that they don't scan. We're a long way from Moon and June kind of rhyming scheme there, you know what I mean? And I think it's a testament to their songwriting ability that they managed to do these things and change them into. And there are several of them here. I think this is a fairly strong album. It's myself and Louise were talking about it outside, and we reckoned maybe that they're not exactly reinventing the wheel or anything like that. You know, it's not a brand new sound for them really or anything like that. But there's some great anthemic rock played by a band that knows what they're doing, with a great singer and a couple of songs there that when I heard them the first time, you were kind of almost whistling along by the time you got to the end of them.
All right.
More for jazz for.
Yeah, let's have a listen to one of those tracks, People Ruin Paintings. People Ruin Paintings from Manic Street Preachers and their new album, Critical Thinking. Yeah, you did hear him say, give me a Pollock, give me a Rothko.
I'll take it.
And then further on, and it's how that lyric twists into People Ruin Paintings, People Destroy the Truth. That's what Manic Street Preachers do, Louise.
And what does it all mean?
Who knows?
Do they mean in the sense of people ruin paintings in protest by throwing soup at the Mona Lisa? Or what I think they may be getting at is that the artist sometimes can ruin the art itself, which they nod to in a big way in the song Dear Stephen, which is all about their complicated feelings about Morrissey, who they all obviously would have idolised when they were growing up in the 70s and 80s. And the Morrissey then is very different to the Morrissey that they are now. And on Dear Stephen, they're just trying to separate who he is from the beliefs that he has, which don't sit well with them.
But the vocalist that we heard on that track is different from how they opened the album, which maybe wasn't the wisest move in the world, was it? Explain, Pat.
Now, that's your man, Nicky Wire, who is the bass.
Who opens the album.
Yeah, and he's actually on three songs on it.
Who was singing?
James Dean Bradley, who's the usual singer, was singing that one there. Nicky Wire is, I think he's the main lyricist as well. Would I be right saying that?
They share duties.
Oh, do they? Okay, right. Fair enough. But he's the guy who maybe they both do come up with that complicated stuff we were talking about earlier on. But the first song, the opening song, which is the title track, is kind of spoiled for me by that, because he's not the most naturally gifted singer in the world. And when you have someone like Bradfield in the band, you wonder why, you'd be pushing to, certainly for, because he's never, I don't think he's ever done that before. I just want to add about that Dear Stephen that I was reading just before we came on, that it actually stems from a postcard that your man Nicky Wire got from Morrissey when he was a teenager, because he was too sick to go to a gig in Wales. And his ma sent, this is a true story apparently, sent a note into the gig or to Morrissey, and he sent back a postcard saying, get well soon. So as well as being about Morrissey's fall from grace, shall we say, politically perhaps, it's also about his obsession with his teenage years and somehow something like that has become talismanic for him. No.
Do you know what? Now that you've done that, I was going to play a little bit of critical thinking, but since neither of you like the Nicky Wire voice, why would I do that? Why don't we listen to a little bit of Dear Stephen? It makes more sense. And there you go. It is a much better song than the opening track, Critical Thinking, which is the title track, obviously, of the album, Manic Street Preachers, for some we're speaking about this evening. Does it work overall for you? Is there enough across the 12 tracks that aren't, and what is it, Nicky Wire, I think, sings two or three of them possibly?
Nicky Wire, yeah, there's a greater sense of shared duties on this song between James Dean Bradfield and Nicky Wire. Poor Sean Moore, the drummer, doesn't really get much of a shoe in what the critical creative output is. But lead opening with Critical Thinking as a song, terrible move, because it sets you kind of looking for flaws. But as it moves on, James Dean Bradfield
it's much better.
It's much cut off song number one. Delightful album from here on, and thematically. Stars. Oh, 3.5 stars.
3.5. What are you saying, Pat?
I like it. Anthemic rock. I think it's a great arrangement. There's one counter melody, sounds like ABBA behind one of the songs. 4 out of 5, and a strong 4 out of 5. I like this.
From Pat. Okay, let's move on to the Lumineers. Very dodgy to start your album. I think it is the opening track, isn't it? Yeah. To start your album with a song called Same Old Song. Same Old Song is what they say they are singing, and it's from an album called Automatic from the Lumineers. I get the distinct impression that there's not a lot of love for this particular album in the room, Louise and Pat. Let's start with you, Louise.
Well, I think fair play to them for maybe hashing out the same old song for the last 20 years, which is how long they've been writing together, but this is just their fifth album. And what they claim this album is about is it's about the increasingly blurry line between what's real and what's not. But that's not something that you really pick up from this album at all. There's a lot of just generic moaning that happens on this album. And
he's talking about emptying the room there.
I'd say he does that all right, yeah.
Well, he sells out arenas, so he's filling rooms, putting bums on seats. But
maybe when he's at a party.
Washing my hair that night, yeah.
But there is, I feel like the Lumineers could fall into the same category as Lewis Capaldi or Dermot Kennedy, but those artists are able to lift their songs to this kind of new level of emotion, which the Lumineers just, they seem to kind of drudge along at the same pace.
Once or twice now, to give them a little bit of defence here, because they do come from that indie folk revival of the 2010s. Some of the acoustic songs, I thought, perhaps, maybe, Pat?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd agree with you, Sean, to be honest
with
you.
That's a clear no.
When you said you were going on this, it's very brave, this same old song, and then to call an album Automatic, and then to put a test card on the front of it. You really are asking for a bruising there, really. And you're going to get it right now. There was only really one song, which was the last one, which was...
Oh, So Long, yeah.
Which kind of started to take off a bit. There was a few times that maybe the arrangements kind of threatened to go somewhere. Mm. Like, there's a song called Atavan, which is got that kind of Radiohead air to
it. Which is one of those acoustic songs.
And there's a bit in the middle where, there's a kind of a bridge where the keyboard starts to do something half interesting. And then it doesn't go anywhere. Yeah. You know, and I think melodically it's uninteresting. It's kind of predictable. I don't think your man has a great voice. I think, Louise, you were being kind of generous to them, really, when you were saying. I mean, when I was looking this up, there were a band I didn't know an awful lot about, I'll admit. But when you find out that they've had, you know, that Ho Hey that you mentioned sold 5 million copies and had 1.5 billion streams or something like that, you go, how?
It was of its time. Well, 2010 was a different world.
Of its time.
This is the wallpaper in a dentist's office. This is, you know, this is a white bread sandwich with mayonnaise in the middle of it and nothing else. It's bland. It's bland.
Would we have a listen to maybe a minute of So Long since you said there's something in it?
Okay.
Find yourself a lover. Give it to another like I did.
God, he does moan quite a bit. He does moan quite a bit, doesn't he? And that was one of the songs that Pat thought was one of the better
all
songs.
Right.
And it's track 10 of 10. Stars from you, Pat?
I might even go as low as one, maybe
all right,
two.
Louise.
I don't know. If
I'll be kinder and give them 2 stars.
Right, one and two. Very different. Okay, let us move on. So that's the Lumineers and Automatic. We're going to come back with Candy Staton after these. Pat Carty, Louise Bruton still with me. We're going to our third album, Caddy Staton's Back to My Roots. She was on the programme with me on Wednesday night. She was a wonderful guest, I have to say. And the album is called Back to My Roots, which is precisely what she does and explains in this song. It's Gonna Rain from Candy Staton and her album Back to My Roots. I played a bit of that the other night as well, Louise, and I didn't get to the sister Maggie who sings the second verse, and I think Candy Staton was very, very tickled by that. But those are her roots, and that's where the majority of this album sits.
Yeah, anyone who'd be familiar with Candy Staton for Young Hearts Run Free or You've Got the Love.
This is different, yeah.
Not a patch of that here, but this is something that she has always dabbled with throughout her career because the gospel and Americana thing is very much a part of her personality and her identity, and it's where she's from as well. I saw her at Beyond the Pale 2 summers ago, and it was a disco sermon because she would stop singing and then just preach for about 7 minutes and, you know, be full of life, and her joy is infectious.
Yeah.
And you can really get this on the album as well. There's an awful lot of God here on this album.
Yeah.
And her God sounds like a good God.
Yeah, well, so. he's certainly looking after her, and that's the way she sings those songs, and you can hear that was there in her childhood from the very beginning. What a voice, full stop. But she's in her 80s, and the voice has still got the strength it seemed it would have had 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, it's remarkable, really, her voice. It hasn't lost a step at all. This is great radio. Look, this is a record from This is her collection. Sorry, I'm holding up for people at home. A collection of her fame recordings from the 60s.
Which, of course, those who are watching
incredible.
Us online can see.
Oh, my God. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. They're incredible. And she's an incredible voice. And just the period you were talking about there, Louise, this is from before that when she was doing Stand By Your Man and stuff like that. And it's really great. And there's some of it here. You know, I would say some of this record works very well. I think it's kind of hindered a bit by some unsympathetic production in places where, you know, it should be maybe a bit warmer and things like that. And it works well on say, like Shine a Light, the Rolling Stones song, which is from the greatest record ever made. So that's a good start anyway. And, you know, she sounds good on that. Probably the highlight of it is, and I think you mentioned this in that great interview, didn't you?
Yeah,
hats off, Sean. That was a really good interview.
Well, she was a good guest. But
1963, sorry.
Yeah, where she talks about the
bombing
of a
battle. And you can hear her kind of voice breaking in it.
I can't play it because you really have to get to the point where the four young girls' names are mentioned or you'd miss the whole point of the song. But what she does in that song and in some of the more powerful kind of, because you were talking about 1963, very specific time in American politics. She's going back there and she's talking about the type of life that she had to live in separated and separatist Alabama.
Yeah, she lived through it. It's not, she said, like, these aren't just anecdotes that she heard, like, she witnessed a lot of it. And with 1963, the day she was in Birmingham when those four girls were killed by the Ku Klux Klan, and she was singing in church when the church deacon came in to say that this had happened. So it was that yeah. life was around her.
Yeah, and I would say if you're going to listen to one track off this album, go and listen to 1963. It's well worth that. But go back and listen to the interview because she's so entertaining, yeah. so informative. It was on Wednesday night's programme.
It's a bit about getting a few bob for...
Oh yeah,
the publishing for what's that song? You know the one
you got the
yeah the famous one. Yeah, I thought that was the great highlight.
Yeah, that
because your man obviously thought it was just going to be nothing.
She thought she was just going to get a fee, and then he said, "No, get 50% of the publishing rights." And sure, it's been covered by so many people. Ooh. She's made a fortune for it, and she loved that. She said, "I just go to the mailbox, pick up me royalties." You mentioned Shine a Light. We'll have a quick listen to that before we finish up. Shine a light, may the good Lord shine a light on you from Gandhi Staten and the album Back to My Roots. Did it work overall for you, Louise, on stars?
Yeah, 3.5 stars for me. I just think you can hear the compassion in her, and you can hear that she's just so happy to be alive. And it's very rare that you can kind of absorb those sort of feelings through a record.
Yeah, and the final song too on the album, which is, I was saying, there's no love on any of her albums tonight. The final song is all about, you know, put the hatred to the one side, and you know, God is involved in a lot of it. So some people might find that, but
God guides us along.
her God's a good guy.
She's on Team God, and he's on her team as well.
And from you, Pat. Stars?
Same. I'd give it more. As I say, the production lets it down a bit, but when it's good, it's good.
Yeah.
You know, and her personality shines through. Yeah. And sure, you know, you can't go wrong there.
Yeah, I'd give it a lot more, but that may be bias on my part. Anyway, Candy Staten, Back to My Roots, final album we spoke about there previous to that, The Lumineers Automatic, Critical Thinking from Manic Street Preachers. Pat Carthy and Louise Bruton are two reviewers on this Friday evening. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening. Researchers by Leah Murphy and Paula Shields. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you on Monday, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.